Coming up, Kim Lawton talks to Reverend Amy Butler, the first female senior minister at New York City's famed Riverside Church, where some of the biggest names in Protestantism have preached. Also, two prominent spiritual teachers on being grateful all the time.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Amid expanded U.S. coalition airstrikes against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, world leaders gathered at the United Nations General Assembly in New York this week. Discussing an international strategy to combat the extremist group was at the top of the agenda. In a speech laden with references to religion, President Obama said military action was necessary because of ISIS's brutal aggression.
No God condones this terror. No grievance justifies these actions. There can be no reasoning, no negotiation with this brand of evil. The only language understood by killers like this is the language of force.
The president emphasized that America is not at war with Islam. This week, a group of more than 120 Muslim scholars and legal experts from around the world issued an open letter in Arabic to ISIS followers and fighters, declaring that the group and its actions violate the Islamic faith. The 18-page letter offers a point-by-point refutation of ISIS based on the Quran and other texts.
Everything they're doing is un-Islamic. Just about every act is forbidden in our faith. So if someone does everything contrary to the faith, how is it the media continues to link them to Islam?
During his trip to Albania last week, Pope Francis called on Muslims and all people of faith to denounce extremists who use religion to justify violence. He said, "To kill in the name of God is a grave sacrilege." And at an interfaith peace conference in India, the Dalai Lama accused ISIS of misusing the concept of jihad. The spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism said real jihad is not to kill in the name of faith, but rather to combat inner destructive emotions. He said everybody carries jihad in their hearts, including me. Meanwhile, humanitarian officials are raising new alarms about the situation for refugees who are fleeing ISIS offensives. This week alone, more than 140,000 Syrians poured across the border into Turkey, and UN officials said they're bracing for the possibility of hundreds of thousands more. Relief groups, including faith-based groups, are trying to provide aid, but are having trouble keeping up with the huge numbers. According to the UN, more than 9 million Syrians have been displaced since 2011, about 40% of the pre-war population. ISIS wasn't the only topic at the General Assembly. Leaders also discussed climate change. There was a strong faith-based contingent as hundreds of thousands of activists took to the streets of New York for the People's Climate March. They urged the international community to take stronger actions to protect the environment. Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Sikh, and Hindu groups were all represented with prayers, banners, and even a float shaped like Noah's Ark. Religious participants said addressing climate change is a moral and religious obligation.
All people of faith agree that protecting creation is an essential part of what we believe. That although God created this wonderful world, it's not up to us to destroy it, but rather to protect it.
General Assembly leaders also focused on the spiraling Ebola crisis in West Africa. International health officials warned that if the disease keeps spreading at its current pace, hundreds of thousands could be infected by the end of the year. Aid groups are seeking additional resources to combat the deadly disease. Saudi Arabia this week unveiled new Ebola screening measures for all arriving airline passengers. The Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca, begins next month with up to 3 million pilgrims expected. In other news, growing numbers of Americans believe the role of religion is waning in public life, according to a new survey from the Pew Research Center. And most Americans think that waning influence is a bad thing. The survey found increases among those who believe that clergy should express political views from the pulpit and that political leaders should pray more often in public. Many Catholics, especially moderates and liberals, are praising Pope Francis' choice for the new Archbishop of Chicago, Bishop Blaise Supich of Spokane. The 65-year-old Supich succeeds Cardinal Francis George, who is retiring after serving there 17 years. Supich is widely seen as a moderate who focuses on social justice, in contrast to the more conservative George, who has emphasized such issues as abortion. Supich said he would not lead with a particular agenda.
I'm going to try to be attentive to what the Lord wants. Maybe if there's moderation in that, then I'm a moderate.
The Vatican announced this week that it has placed under house arrest a former archbishop accused of sex crimes against children. 66-year-old Joseph Wesolowski was defrocked in June for sexually abusing boys in the Dominican Republic while serving there as a papal envoy. He'll be tried at the Vatican, the first time it has ever held a criminal trial for child sex abuse. Wesolowski faces up to 12 years in prison if convicted. The Episcopal Church's presiding bishop, Catherine Jeffords Shorey, announced this week that she will not seek a second term. She was elected presiding bishop in 2006, the first woman to hold that position. Jeffords Shorey would have been eligible for re-election, but she said she wanted to open the door for someone else who will be elected next summer. Although Jeffords Shorey's election was seen as a breakthrough for women in religious leadership, many female clergy say they continue to experience what some have called a stained glass ceiling that limits their opportunities. Nevertheless, in 2014, three of the nation's most prominent mainline Protestant congregations have chosen female senior pastors for the first time. One of them is the historic Riverside Church in New York City, where Reverend Amy Butler will be installed as senior minister on October 5th. Kim Lawton reports.
It's the tallest church in America, and in many ways, the Riverside Church in Manhattan was the country's original Protestant megachurch. The soaring neo-Gothic cathedral was built in 1927 by industrialist John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Over the decades, the interdenominational congregation has hosted many prominent preachers, people like Harry Emerson Fosdick, Martin Luther King Jr., William Sloan Coffin, and James Forbes.
The people who have stood in that pulpit reads like a who's who of 20th century world Protestantism.
Now Riverside has a new senior minister, Reverend Amy Butler, the first woman to hold that position.
Let's do this. Coming into this incredible pulpit at the Riverside Church where these amazing voices have spoken is a daunting and important thing.
To simply have her name and that pulpit put together in the same sentence says this is an important leader.
In 2014, three of the nation's most influential mainline Protestant congregations called female senior pastors for the first time. Reverend Shannon Johnson Kirshner at Chicago's 4th Presbyterian Church, Reverend Ginger Gaines Sorelle at Foundry United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C., and Butler at Riverside, which is affiliated with the United Church of Christ and the American Baptist Churches USA. Author and scholar Diana Butler Bass, no relation to Amy, says this signals a key shift for American mainline Protestantism.
It is hard to imagine as recently as even 20 years ago, that these historically important churches would have wound up hiring women, much less sort of three women coalescing at the same time.
Butler grew up in Hawaii, the eldest of five children.
I felt the call to ministry very early. I grew up in a home of very devout parents, and I felt a calling to be part of the church. I loved it, but I never saw a woman in leadership.
She attended Baylor University, where she took some theology classes and then decided to go on to seminary.
When I graduated from seminary, I couldn't find a job at a church. And so I took a job running a homeless shelter for 8 years in the city of New Orleans. And that's where I always say I learned how to be a pastor there.
Butler eventually did get an assistant pastor job in New Orleans. And then in 2003, she was called to be senior pastor at Calvary Baptist Church in Washington, where she was for the last decade. She says her style as a pastor is collaborative rather than authoritarian.
That's just not going to fly. Someone standing up in the pulpit telling people what to do, it's not going to work. And that's not my approach anyway. I want to be on a journey together with my congregation, and I'm really hoping that the person that you would see in the pulpit would be the person you would see outside the pulpit.
Butler says she wants to develop a church setting where she and her congregation members can wrestle together with difficult questions.
What does the Bible mean in our day and age? Does it mean anything? Or does God exist? Questions like that people are wondering. And then to get to a personal level, I'm in pain. My child is sick. Where is God in all of this? I need to ask those questions, and I need to have a safe place where I can just say, I don't know the answers.
She's open about her own struggles, including a painful divorce and the challenges of being a single mother to three children, ages 20, 17, and 16.
I want to be in a community of people who see me as a real person, who is asking these questions, who is living through points of pain and fear and questioning, just like they are.
According to Duke University's new National Congregations Study, only 11% of American congregations are led by women. Many of the nation's largest Christian denominations hold the theological position that women should not be pastors. Even among those that do allow female ordination, many women pastors report ongoing discrimination.
It is still very difficult for women to find jobs in this profession. What I always say, do very well. Do your work well. Do your work well. And sometimes that means you have to do it a little better.
Come on, people of God.
Ironically, declining numbers in mainline denominations appear to have made new inroads for female pastors.
Forward.
Because as the denominations lost prestige and men went to other careers, women who felt callings to these careers suddenly had pathways opened up that they never had before. I suspect that when history of this time is written in another 50 or 100 years, it might look like the women actually saved these denominations.
Bass says, like women in many other professions, women in religious leadership are often still judged on the basis of gender.
They want to be judged for who they are, distinctively and uniquely, and they want to be judged for the work that they do. But we all know that that's not the case, especially for women who are the first to do something. That just attracts a sort of a public gaze, and you do become a representative whether you want to or not.
Butler will face scrutiny as she tackles the specific challenges at Riverside. The congregation has been without a full-time senior pastor for the last 5 years. The previous senior minister, Brad Braxton, resigned in 2009, less than a year after his installation, amid internal divisions over his leadership style and compensation.
When a congregation goes through that kind of leadership crisis, it's never pleasant, and it wears away at the fabric of the congregation.
Although Riverside has more than 1,600 members, those numbers are down significantly from just a few years ago. Another complication is the multicultural makeup of the congregation.
Diverse community is very difficult. It's very difficult to live in close community with people whom we don't understand, who don't understand us. That's why most churches look the same when you look around the room.
But perhaps the biggest challenge will be crafting a vision for the congregation in a society that is vastly different from Riverside's glory days as the national voice of social justice.
It once was the case that all William Sloan Coffin or James Forbes or back in the old days, Harry Emerson Fosdick had to do was simply get up and say something, and the media would throng there and say, oh my gosh, Fosdick says this. But it won't be quite that way with Amy. Religion doesn't have that space in culture anymore, especially in a city like New York.
Butler says she's hopeful about the possibilities of what Riverside can become in this new environment.
Probably if you and I were going to build a church from scratch today, we wouldn't build a big cathedral like this. But here we are in the middle of this powerful city, and I want to cast a vision around which a community of people can gather and invest and change the world.
Despite surveys documenting rising numbers of Americans who do not want to affiliate with institutional religion, Butler says she's not worried that this will mean the demise of churches.
One of the things that we're hearing all the time is the death of the institutional church. The church is dying. And I'm telling you that some expression of the institutional church will always be around because people are asking deep questions and because people need community.
How Riverside and Butler negotiate this new era could provide a model for all mainline Protestantism. I'm Kim Lawton in New York.
We don't often on this program get to listen to a conversation between two prominent spiritual teachers. But earlier this year in Northern California, producer Kate Olson sat in on just such an event. Jack Kornfield is a prominent Buddhist leader. Brother David Steindl Rast is a well-known Christian, a Benedictine monk. Their topic was living gratefully.
Gratefulness is there from the very beginning because it is always a loving listening to whatever comes your way. And if you lovingly listen to it, you are grateful for it. It has these three steps that we have talked about many times. The stopping, the looking, opening your heart in every respect, and then the doing, the responding. And all three must come together.
A couple of years ago, the Washington Post hired the world-famous violinist Joshua Bell to take his Stradivarius and play in the Washington subway, in the metro, play these amazing Bach pieces during rush hour. He was playing Lincoln Center that night for $200 a ticket or something, put out his hat, and after an hour, he got $14, and no one stopped except for children. The only people, everybody else was on their way, and the only people who stopped to hear this extraordinary music, I'm sorry, I've got to get somewhere, were the children who tugged on their parents' arms and said, wait, there's something going on here worth paying attention to. It's not an easy thing, actually, to listen, because also there are the barriers. We have the unfinished business of the heart, and when people start to get quiet and listen, sometimes what happens is the tears come because they have to grieve something that they've been too busy to feel or some longing or something that's in there. My friend Annie Lamott says, the mind is like a bad neighborhood. I try not to go there alone.
No, the stopping is the first step towards it. That because otherwise I get carried away. I'm in a rush. Our life is a rush. Whether you are a monk or an executive.
Monk's rush. You got to get this. So there's company. You're in good company.
I think you come to the practice through the fact that gratefulness happens to you when something, two things have to come together. Something has to be valuable to you, and you have to become aware that it's given to you. Then spontaneously in everybody's heart, gratefulness arises. And then you see, ah, this feels so good, you see. This is a joy. It gives us joy. But then you have to make one more step to really make this joy permanent and at least accessible at every moment. And you have to realize that every moment is such a gift. Immediately, of course, people ask, can you really be grateful for everything? And the answer is no, you can't be grateful for everything. But I didn't say you can be grateful for everything. I said you can be grateful in every moment, because in every moment, an opportunity is given to you. And the gift within every gift is opportunity. So opportunity, that is the decisive thing. And when you stop, you realize the opportunity that is now given to you. Unless you stop, you will never realize this opportunity to learn
some lesson.
Or the opportunity to stand up and be counted and protest and demonstrate.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So, but most of the time, it's the opportunity to enjoy.
And one of the things that I've learned for myself over the years of meditation, my own meditation practice has gotten quite simple, really. I do it not to get anywhere. I've been a lot of places, and thank you, that's great. But I sit sometimes to clear out because I get too busy and my body gets a little tense and I get filled with too many thoughts. And so it's sort of like flossing or something like that. There's some, you know. Seriously, you know what I mean. It's a clearing. And then it's more about being, because there is only one place to be, which is where you are, where we are now. And the other thing that seems really important is that spiritual life can easily become mapped in our heart somehow with grim duty or some kind of thing that you have to do to fix yourself, right? You go to the gym and you jog and you get therapy, you know, and you do your meditation and you diet properly and things like that. And there are disciplines that are worthwhile, but if the discipline doesn't have some love in it, it's really not going to serve you. Somebody said the question is not the future of humanity, but the presence of eternity. Mm-hmm. And that the invitation of meditation and the joy that you talk about is more allowing ourselves to shift from doing to the quality of, I called it loving awareness, gratitude, sacred presence, to the mystery of being here. So,
and this underlines an important fact, namely that this stopping is an expression of your trust in life.
That's beautiful.
When we trust life, then we go with the flow, and then life will give us one opportunity after the other. We have this saying, opportunity knocks only once. I don't know who invented that. It's the most stupid thing in the world. Opportunity knocks every moment, and if you miss this opportunity, there's another one. And if you miss this one, another one. And life is overflowing. It's so abundant, gives us one opportunity after the other. What you see when you stop and look is opportunity, whatever the opportunity may be. And if you take that opportunity, that's the goal. See, that's then the... Before that, gratefulness isn't really full. It's full when you give thanks. And you give thanks not by saying thank you, obviously, but by doing something with the opportunity that is given to you. And we can try it out. If you make up your mind, I will be a little... stop, look, go from now until tomorrow morning. I can assure you tomorrow morning you will be more joyful. It works. It's just a matter of trying it out. And if we become more joyful people, that's all that's asked of us. We don't have to change the world. If there are enough joyful people, there will be a more joyful world. And that's really how it works.
Finally, the holiest time on the Jewish calendar began this week with Rosh Hashanah, the new year, the high holidays, and next week with Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Also, Hindus began celebrating Navaratri, a 9-day festival honoring their divine mother, Durga. And that's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website where there's always much more and where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from the annual Unity Walk in Washington, D.C., where people of different faiths came together for a day of service and getting to know one another.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.